From WGCU News, this is Gulf Coast Live. Sunday marked the deadliest mass shooting in modern U.S. history when gunman Omar Mateen opened fire in the gay nightclub Pulse in Orlando, killing 49 people and injuring 53 others before being killed in a gun battle with law enforcement. Doctors say that with several victims still in critical condition, the death toll could rise. As vigils are being held around the world, we'll get the latest on the investigation into the shooting. We'll explore impacts on Florida's LGBT community and violence against people based on their perceived sexual orientation or gender identity. We'll also explore concerns from the local Muslim community and how the mass shooting could influence the nation's gun control debate going forward. First, this news. This is Gulf Coast Live from WGCU News. I'm John Davis. Thanks for joining us. Early Sunday morning marked the deadliest mass shooting in modern U.S. history when a gunman opened fire in the gay nightclub Pulse in Orlando, taking hostages and killing 49 people. 53 others were injured before being killed in a gun battle with police. Doctors say that with several victims still in critical condition, the death toll could rise. Vigils are being held around the globe as people all over the world stand in solidarity with the victims and their loved ones. Meanwhile, in the days since the shooting, more information has been coming out about the shooter, Omar Mateen of Fort Pierce, and his possible motives. The head of the FBI and the Homeland Security Secretary briefed members of Congress about the massacre Tuesday. About 20 minutes into the attack, Mateen called 911 dispatchers, pledging allegiance to ISIS and expressing solidarity with the Boston Marathon bombers. At the request of the St. Lucie County Sheriff's Office, Mateen had been investigated by the FBI in 2013 over inflammatory comments he'd made while working as a security guard at the St. Lucie County Courthouse. Again in 2014, Mateen was interviewed by the FBI over possible connections to an American suicide bomber. Officials say Mateen was just one of hundreds of people on the FBI's radar as suspected ISIS sympathizers, but that there was no indication he was plotting to carry out the attack. The Orlando Sentinel reports regular customers of the Pulse nightclub say they remember seeing Mateen at the club before and that Mateen had used a gay dating and chat app. That raised speculation that Mateen's actions, at least in part, may have been motivated by internal struggles regarding his own sexuality. As the city of Orlando continues to mourn and heal from the tragic mass shooting, we'll explore impacts on Florida's and the nation's LGBT community and violence against people based on their perceived sexual orientation or gender identity. We also explore concerns from the Muslim community as threats to mosques in Florida began shortly after news of the mass shooting spread. Joining me now, hopefully later in the hour, we'll be speaking with Cody Delaney. He's been reporting on the mass shooting in Orlando for the News Press here in Fort Myers and USA Today. So when we get him on the phone, we'll be able to get the latest information coming out there. But at the moment, we're joined in studio by Arlene Goldberg. She's co-founder and board member of Visuality Incorporated, which provides a safe, open environment for Southwest Florida's LGBTQ youth and advocates on their behalf. Arlene and her late wife, Carol Goldwasser, were among the eight couples who were plaintiffs in the lawsuit that led to Florida officially recognizing same-sex marriages. Arlene, welcome back to the show.
Thank you.
Also with us in studio is Muhammad Al-Darsani. He's the imam and founder of the Islamic Center for Peace in Fort Myers. In addition to conducting worship services, Al-Darsani directs the center's Islamic studies, community outreach initiatives, interfaith dialogues, and faith-based counseling services. Welcome back to Gulf Coast Live.
Thank you for having me.
And joining us from Orlando is Joe Saunders. He's the Southern Regional Field Director for the Human Rights Campaign. In 2012, Saunders became one of the first openly gay members elected to the Florida House, representing Central Florida District 49. Good to speak with you again, Joe.
Thanks for having me.
And Hannah Willard joins us by phone as well. She's Policy and Outreach Coordinator for Equality Florida, the state's largest LGBT civil rights advocacy organization. Thanks for your time today, Hannah.
Thank you for having me.
And we're talking with communication professor Dr. Billy Huff. Huff remains an adjunct professor here at Florida Gulf Coast University, but will soon start a new position at the University of South Florida. Huff is also a Visuality Incorporated board member. Thanks for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
I also invite listeners to join the conversation and connect with our guests with your comments and questions. Phone lines are open at 1-877-428-8255. 877-927-8255. That's 877-GCU-TALK. Send email to GulfCoastLive@WGCU.org. Comment on our Facebook page at WGCU Public Media or tweet using the hashtag Gulf Coast Live. And Joe Saunders, I just wanted to start with you because I know that you had attended the recent vigil in Orlando. Can you just maybe kind of give us your general impressions of that event? Did you speak at the event?
I did. I helped to organize it and convene it along with Anna Willard, who's on the phone with you, and the staff at Equality Florida, and with support from the LGBT Community Center of Orlando.
Tell us about the event itself. I mean, I'm sure it was a very somber occasion. Was there a good turnout? What do you think people needed from that event or took from that vigil?
Well, I think the Orlando LGBT community and the broader Orlando community in general is still reeling. It doesn't feel like it's been just a few days since we heard the news of what happened on Saturday night and Sunday morning, but it really has. That event came together very quickly. I think we had a total of 8 hours to organize an event that we believe well over 10,000 people eventually attended.
Wow.
It was beautifully sad, but still beautiful. It was an event that had speakers from all across the Central Florida community, major LGBT, local leadership, statewide leaders like Equality Florida's Executive Director, Nadine Smith, National President of the Human Rights Campaign from Washington, D.C., Chad Griffin, joined us. We even had speakers from Mother Emanuel Church in Charleston, South Carolina, a church that has experienced its own bit of horror and gun violence. So we had representation from the Hispanic community present, a community that has been disproportionately affected by this crisis. It was Latin night at Pulse on Saturday night, and 9 out of 10 of the names of those we've lost are people of Hispanic and Latino descent. But it was a beautiful moment in that the entire community in Orlando came together in almost a moment's notice to mourn and to grieve and to cry. The major messages I think we heard were messages about love and about abandoning hate and not giving into the temptation to match the intention of the attacker. But there were also some really political messages about guns and about bigotry and about discrimination. And I think that was an important part of what we talked about as a community on Monday as well.
All right. And hopefully we'll be able to get reporter Coney Delaney on the line here. But in the meantime, I wanted to ask you about something that Cody had actually tweeted during the vigil. And I think this relates to a song. I'm hoping you might be able to provide some context to it if you can. But he had written, quote, "There's 50 cars left in the parking lot. 50 mothers left at the door." Was that anything that you were aware of as that song was being sung?
No, there were two beautiful performances by the Orlando Gay Chorus. They started us off by singing True Colors, the Cyndi Lauper song that has a deep connection to the LGBT community. And they closed with a fairly famous Broadway song, "You'll Never Walk Alone." A particularly beautiful moment was at the end of the vigil, which lasted about an hour and a half, when, as a way to close us out and give people a chance to disperse, the song "Let It Be" from the Beatles was played. And in a moment when we thought everyone would be ready to leave, in fact, people stayed and relit their candles and sang along. And that's how we closed things out.
And Dr. Huff, I know you were at the Tampa vigil. Can you tell us a bit about that event and your impressions?
Yes, it was also a very somber event. It was on Sunday night, and I had just returned from Philadelphia from a transgender conference on a big high about the welcoming inclusion that I experienced there, and came back and found out about this. I was struck by the amount of people that they were able to organize and mobilize in such a quick amount of time, and yes, it was also a very somber and sad time.
All right. And Arlene Goldberg, I'm sorry I didn't mean to elicit that emotional reaction from you reading the words to that song, but was there something you would want to add?
Well, here in Fort Myers, we're having our vigil on Saturday at 7 o'clock at Centennial Park. We're expecting a few thousand people, which is really big for Fort Myers. And we're all very sad. I mean, it was just, it wasn't shocking because we expect these kinds of things to happen, unfortunately. But where it happened, we're a place of love, a place where people gather to feel free, was shocking.
Joe, I know you in particularly are an active member of the LGBT community in the Orlando area and really the general Orlando community. Did you yourself lose friends in Sunday's attack?
I did. We lost my friend Drew Linen, and I had first met Drew when I was a student at UCF. I was a leader in the local LGBT student organization, the LGBT student union. And I first met Drew when he came, like the rest of us, looking for a place that was safe, a place to find community in our adopted home at UCF. I met him there and have known him for 10 years. We lost Drew and we lost his boyfriend Juan on Saturday night.
Oh, Joe, I'm really sorry to hear that. What kind of general impressions are you kind of getting from folks in Orlando now? Or are people expressing fear about going out or visiting particularly gay establishments?
I think I've gotten that question quite a bit, and I imagine it has as well. The night after the news broke on, we woke up on Sunday morning to this horror, and that night, another iconic LGBT institution in the LGBT Orlando community, the Parliament House, which is another club. It's another late night bar that folks go to. It's world famous. That very night, the Parliament House opened its doors and invited people to come to see a drag show, to mourn, to cry, to have fun, to do whatever they wanted to do. And every report that I've heard is that it was filled to capacity that night. I think the LGBT community's first response has been shock, the second has been grief, and the third has been defiance. And I think the broader Orlando community has shared in that defiance when 10,000 people, after one of the worst terrorist attacks our country may have seen, a hate motivated, an act motivated by bigotry and discrimination, but a terrorist attack when 2 days after that attack happens in our town, 10,000 people come to an open space in front of the Dr. Phelps Performing Arts Center to green and mourn. I think that's an act of defiance, and I think that's where the Orlando community is today.
Arlene?
Yeah, I understand we received a call from the Department of Law, Florida Law Enforcement. The call went to the Fort Myers Police Department, and they wanted to know where in our area we were having LGBT events happening from now and through October.
Wow.
And I was glad.
This isn't just visuality. This is bars, restaurants.
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah, they asked me to please report to them any of the events that were happening in the LGBT community now through October. And I was glad to hear that because they're reacting in a positive way and they're being careful.
Yeah, proactive.
Proactive, right. Yeah. And so that's what I'm in the process of doing. Every time I hear of one, I am reporting it to them so they can have, like Saturday night for our vigil, a candlelight vigil, they're having extra security there, and so is the sheriff's department. So we're thankful for that.
Yeah. I know when I woke up Sunday morning, my first thought was getting in touch with my friends in the Orlando area, making sure that they were okay. And kind of after that initial shock, one of the very first thoughts I had was about the arson at the upstairs lounge in New Orleans French Quarter back in 1973 that killed 32 people. I was wondering if anyone else here on the panel had thought about that as well and sort of made that contrast. No. The reason I thought about it was and I was also thinking about possibly I don't want to say a silver lining because that's completely the wrong word for this. But the reaction back in 73 to that arson attack, which until Sunday had been, the most significant attack on a gay establishment. you know, media coverage was almost non-existent. Editorials and talk show radio hosts made light of the event. The investigation yielded no arrests. No politicians ever publicly discussed the attack because the victims were gay. And I just wonder if, in contrast, you know, looking at back 1973 to where we are in 2016 and how this is being handled, if any of you had sort of thought about that and whether or not, you know, it is kind of an expression of social progress that's been made.
Well, you know, I immediately thought about the Stonewall riots. Of course, that is right. The act of defiance that Joe is talking about that took place in 1969 in New York City. June is LGBTQ Pride Month. It's the month that we mark those Stonewall riots. It's the month that we mark that act of defiance, that act of anger, when the LGBTQ community fought back against our oppressors. And this month being a time when we come together at Pride festivals and Pride parades to celebrate our community. This year, it's going to be a time when we continue to come together to grieve. And I second Arlene's comment about the increased desire for law enforcement to provide security for these gatherings for the LGBTQ community. But we are even further committed to coming out, speaking up, and standing up as we celebrate our community, as we grieve those we have lost. This month will still go down as the month when we won our historic marriage equality victory just last year. Unfortunately, this will be the month when we have the deadliest attack on LGBTQ people in history as well. And so it's especially prescient that this attack happened during the month of June. But what I do know is LGBTQ people are no stranger to adversity, and we are no stranger to violence, and that makes us no stranger to getting back up and moving forward even stronger than ever. And I'm proud of the ways in which our community has already done that.
And Mohammed Al-Darsani, you wanted to say something?
Sure, thank you. First, let me start by repeating what I've been saying and what every really Muslim leader and teacher and activist in the whole country has been saying, that our hearts and condolences are with the families of the victims, really, and with the whole community, the LGBT community. And the reason I'm saying that is through the years, the LGBT community was standing out by standing with the Muslim community against the persecution that is being gone through. And they were speaking loudly against Islamophobia. And we appreciate that from them. And it is our time now, or our turn, to return the favor and say they are a community that deserve the respect and deserve the compassion of the community at large. The sad thing I need to mention here, this is not, I know that the criminal was a Muslim. It's unfortunate he is a Muslim, but he is not a representation of Islam and what Islam really teaches about dealing with these kind of communities or minorities in general or any people who are different. But this is a social problem all over the world. And unfortunately, in a free society like ours, it manifests itself greatly. Sunday, just a few hours of the incident, a preacher in California, and I'm sure probably you saw all of you saw that on the news, national news, from his pulpit, praising the attack, and condemning the victims and saying they deserve it, and he wishes if the whole community can be eliminated. We're against that. The Muslim community leaderships and all the organizations being condemning the act, condemning the crooked understanding of Islam and the people who carry these acts, no matter who they are, especially if they are Muslims. And they were actively coming out in support, including fundraising, including teaching, including having meetings and any kind of support they can show to the whole community and especially to the LGBT community because of its past with us. That's number one. Locally here, I'm trying to do my best, and many of other Muslims trying to do their best to participate in all of the activities to show our support and give our condolences. On the 25th of this month, we at the Islamic Center for Peace are having an interfaith dinner, and I already invited some members of the LGBT community to be with us. And I want the faith leaders who are going to attend in there to dedicate some time before we have our iftar. It is in Ramadan. That is the dinner in Ramadan. To sit down and discuss how we can work together more effectively to deal with these kind of things, at least at our establishments.
Right. Arlene had talked about, you know, getting the police getting in touch with her and talking about, you know, wanting to know when events were going to be occurring. Do you have any kind of similar relationship with law enforcement?
Let me tell you some very positive things about the law enforcement, starting from 9/11. When 9/11 happened, I got very concerned. So I went to protect the mosque by myself. Okay, so I went to be the guard of the mosque, small mosque on Broadway Avenue at that time. So to my surprise, we got many, many phone messages, one negative one, and the rest were all supports. Then people started showing up and people started sending flowers. To my surprise, without asking the police for any kind of protection, we found out they started doing that from hour one. The sheriff at that time decided to send deputies and undercover people and police cars parked around the area strictly to make sure nobody comes and touch the Muslims or the mosque. This is the truth. And we heard about the investigation. We were talking before the show started about the investigation against Omar back in 2013 and 2004. Yes. This kind of investigations, and I'm saying this so nobody will accuse the FBI or any law enforcement for failing to detect this lone wolf. It is impossible for anybody to detect a lone wolf activist. Impossible. They do their best. They met with him, and I'm sure they did their best. They do a thorough job in protecting the people, not just the American society. Everybody who lives in this country, on this society, is protected by the law enforcement agencies, all of them, with no exceptions. We know they do their best to do that, but sometimes somebody will fail through the cracks, will fall and do something horrible that will reflect on the relationship between the law enforcement and certain communities. Now, we here in Southwest Florida, I'm not aware of any threats or any negative reaction. Thank God this is the way it is always. We have a few minor things, but in other cities and other places, I heard there were some threats, there were some accusations, some fear-mongering, and all kind of negative reactions. However, the law enforcement is there. We know they are there, and they are doing a good job, and we do appreciate that. What I would like to see, we're going to invite some law enforcement to participate in our discussion on the 25th. What I would like to see, the law enforcement is having more interactive relationship strictly with the faith community and the educational community in general, because this is a phenomenon. This is one incident by a Muslim, but we have tens others that went by non-Muslims are very similar, and some of them are close in victim numbers. We have a guy who got arrested just a few hours after what happened in Orlando, going to massacre the same members from the same community in a parade, and he was loaded with ammunition and explosive materials and all kind of other things. So this is something the whole community of faith, the law enforcement, educational institutions should work on and start looking into solution and see what the reasons behind this madness that is getting out of control, really.
Mm-hmm. I'm glad you brought up the incident with the Indiana man intercepted by law enforcement heading to the L.A. Pride Festival with a cache of weapons, devices for materials for making explosives. And, we know from previous editions of this program, we've talked about how 2015 was actually the deadliest year on record in the U.S. for transgender persons. I guess, and I'll throw this out to everybody on the panel here, is there concern or do you see evidence that these kinds of violent attacks against people over their perceived gender identity or sexual orientation are increasing as social acceptance also increases?
I would like to say I'm sorry.
Oh, go ahead, Billy.
Go ahead.
Okay. Whenever we have social progress and the history of IT social movements, there's always backlash. So it's definitely not to be unexpected. And the violence certainly didn't come from nowhere. And I'm glad that you mentioned the trans bathroom issue. Especially trans women of color, experience a large amount of violence daily in the United States right now. And so it's a problem that has gotten worse. I think that it's good that we're talking about these things instead of maybe moments of silence that don't really fix anything, and that we should be talking more about these issues.
I think we need to continue the dialogue so it doesn't lapse in order to make any progress.
All right. Yes, Mohammed Al-Darsani.
Yes, please. Let me clarify something here now. You mentioned that 2015 was a record year for this kind of violence and discrimination against the community. I'm here really to represent the Islamic point of view,
yes,
more than Muslims. Okay. Mm. Now, in Islam, the transsexual people are treated equally like everybody else. I see the shock on your face.
Yeah,
you are.
I am.
I'm sure you are. Even the gays, nobody, no individual, not even the highest authority, so-called, in an Islamic society, has the right to persecute them or discriminate against them, much less to murder them. Unless that. Now, let me clear something else. Islam views the homosexuality as a sin, as Christianity and Judaism and many other ideologies and isms in the world view it. However, this is not a base for discrimination. Their rights 100% preserved. And this is will shock you more. The Prophet of Islam himself, Muhammad, used to have a friend who was a transgender person. And he used to come and sit with the Prophet's wives in his absence. Imagine. It was okay. Now, natural inclination because of any kind of reasons are not the basis to discriminate. Your civil rights are protected 100%. Your life is protected at all time. And individuals, Muslim individuals, whether in an Islamic society or outside of an Islamic society, have no right to exercise any prejudice, pass any judgment and carry any violence against anybody in the name of the religion. So what happened really is against Islam. And if this guy, Omar, understood his deen and he was doing this on Islamic basis, he got it totally 100% wrong. Second, if you notice when he pledged allegiance, we don't pledge allegiance to an organization, to a state in Islam. We pledge allegiance to obey God, and that's it. And that was absence of his. He pledged allegiance to a crooked group just like him who are killing innocent Muslims by the tens of thousands. As we speak right now, probably within this 1 hour will be more than 100 or 200 people will be killed by ISIS or their actions or the results of their actions in Iraq and Syria as we are speaking right now. So those people don't represent Islam. And the crooked understanding of Islam for those sick-minded people, unfortunately, is causing us all these problems.
Well, with that?
Oh, Cody, are you with us now?
Yes, I am.
Oh, okay, sorry about that. Cody had a late flight and so didn't quite get in right where he is. Well, Cody, we're going to get right to you here just to get the latest on your reporting. But Arlene, I wanted to turn to you now. You wanted to say something?
No.
Oh, okay. Cody.
I want to hear Cody.
All right. First of all, Cody, tell us about when did you arrive in Orlando? And tell us about, you know, the scene you saw around the Pulse nightclub when you were there.
Yeah. First of all, I just wanted to apologize for showing up so late. I had quite the layover at the airport.
Hey, you weren't flying the plane. Don't worry about it.
Yeah. So I actually got to Orlando Sunday around noon, and as soon as I got there, it was a really hectic scene. Police had shut down many of the major thoroughfares, major roadways. Getting around was quite the challenge, and also getting your bearings, trying to figure out, I've only been to Orlando a couple times, so really trying to figure out where to go, you know, where's the story leading me? And once I had that, it was all downhill from there. Just being able to have the people tell me their stories and what was going on.
Yeah, there was one individual who survived, Eddie Meltzler. Tell me about your conversation with him and what he told you.
Yeah, Eddie, he just happened to be standing around at one of the kind of these makeshift memorials at the hospital. And he was just standing around. I walked up to him and said, hey, you know, were you involved in this mass shooting? And did you know anybody involved? And he very matter-of-factly says, oh, yeah, four of my friends were killed. And, you know, immediately I started asking more questions, and I learned that he left the nightclub 5 minutes before the shooting actually started. He said, I just didn't feel right. I was getting nauseous. You know, something was telling me I had to leave. So he ended up leaving his friends, and 5 minutes later, they were trapped in that, you know, three-hour hostage standoff. It was pretty amazing to hear what he had to say. And, you know, and they keep talking about the survivor's guilt and the kind of feelings that come around from that, you know, leaving your friends to die. And he said, you know, I'm not going to pay attention to that. You know, I'm going to live my life the way my friends would have wanted me to, and, you know, advocate for peace and love as opposed to being angry about what this person did to my friends.
Yeah.
Which I thought was really amazing.
Yeah, in your reporting, that's what struck out to me, I think, more than anything else was his recognizing that, of course, he felt that rage, but then refused to succumb to it.
Yeah, and that's one thing he said is, I absolutely felt angry, but, you know, being angry is going to lead me nowhere. That's exactly what they wanted. That's what these, you know, terrorists want from us, is to feel anger, and he wasn't going to subscribe to that.
I know you've also spoken with members of the surgical team at the Orlando Regional Medical Center. What can you tell us about what they told you regarding, you know, the immediate emergency medical response in the aftermath?
First of all, being able to talk to them I was surprised that I was going to be able to talk to them so quickly after everything happened. You know, this is less than 24 hours after they had, you know, dealt with, I think 44 people came in with gunshot wounds, and for a hospital that size, normally they'll deal with maybe six people with gunshot wounds on any given night. But to have 44 come in all during this incredibly short window of time, it was something they weren't prepared for. I mean, they had trained for this, but they had to call in extra hands, extra help to get people in. And within an hour, they had six surgeons, you know, in operating rooms helping people. But just dealing with the chaos of having all these people come in with gunshot wounds, and many of whom were unable to even identify who they were because they were either unconscious or in shock, weren't able to form complete sentences. So just getting these people identified and reuniting them with their families was such a challenge. And that's the other thing is, you know, many of these family, friends and family members, they went hours and hours and hours without having any idea what the status was of their loved one. And that was just another thing, challenging thing for the doctors is, you know, we needed to get these people treated, get them identified, and let their families know that, you know, either they're okay or they're no longer with us. And that was incredibly powerful.
Yeah. I mean, do you have any kind of updates on, you know, how many life-saving surgeries have been performed so far? How many victims may still be in critical condition? I had read yesterday that the death toll might actually rise in the coming days.
Yeah. Well, I left New Orleans, or I left Orlando, and I left Monday night. So all I know at this point is they performed 26 surgeries the day of the shooting.
And those have been continuing since then. Wow. Yeah.
Yeah, the following day they had something like 10 performed as well. So it was just, it was pretty hectic for everybody involved.
All right. Well, Cody, thank you so much. Is there anything else you'd want to tell us about your reporting or your experience reporting on the aftermath of the shooting before we let you go? I know you're a busy guy.
It was by far the most difficult thing I'd ever had to do professionally and even in my personal life. I was sent out with Andrew West. He's actually an award-winning photographer with the News Press. And there were several times where he and I, we had to stop what we were doing. We made eye contact, and we both just looked at each other and just said, wow. Like, it was just such deep, raw human emotion that we were dealing with. And, you know, there wasn't much we could do other than document what was going on and, you know, help tell their stories. And just being able to separate yourself from that and tell an accurate, fair story, and also sensitive because of the subject matter, was incredibly difficult. And I know myself and Andrew West, we both struggled with that throughout our time in Orlando.
Well, Cody Delaney is a News Press reporter. He was in Orlando in the aftermath of Sunday's mass shooting at the Pulse nightclub there, reporting for the News Press and for USA Today. Cody Delaney, thanks so much for joining us.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Let's take a call now from Paul in Moorhaven. Paul, thanks for waiting, and welcome to Gulf Coast Live.
Yes, well, it's good to be here. In listening to your show, and by the way, I listen to you every day, and it's fun to talk to the voice instead of just hear it. but anyway, my cousin was Allen Ginsberg, and in the 60s we used to chat. And he was beyond in the closet. In those days, it was underground. If you were gay, it was like an underground thing. There wasn't even the luxury of saying, are you in the closet or out of the closet? It was just a very fierce time for gay people. And what's striking to me now, which this situation in Orlando, what happened, an awakening to me, was the outpouring of love from this entire country to the people involved, just like in the shooting at the schools or the movie theater. There's a common love for also people who were at the Pulse. And to me, that is an awakening, even though I was aware of the acceptance and aware of the political gains. To me, it was an awakening to see the outpouring of love from the time in the 60s that I can remember to now, where it's just wonderful, even though it's a horrible situation, it's wonderful to see the outpouring of love for also the people who were involved in last week's hellish actions.
Well, Paul, thank you so much for the call and for your comment. And, you know, I have to say, Allen Ginsberg, I first discovered his poetry in high school, and it opened up a whole new world for me. So great to meet a relative. Thanks for calling, and I really appreciate your comments.
Last words to me before his tragic death.
Hopelessly
heterosexual.
Can you say that again, Paul? Yes. We lost you a little bit.
Yeah, his last words to me, I and it was just spooky, but his last words to me were, Paul, you're hopelessly heterosexual. So that's, you know, that was his wit, and I loved him for it. But anyway, sir, you have a great rest of the day, and thank you for the direction that you have your station on.
All right, thank you. Thanks so much, Paul. And Joe, I wanted to ask you about something. On a previous edition of this show, we'd had a discussion on the future of the LGBT rights movement following the U.S. Supreme Court's ruling that legalized same-sex marriage nationwide. And in that conversation, we talked about this pervasive public perception that with legal same-sex marriage, the fight for equality had been won. For example, you know, many people I've talked to didn't realize that in the state of Florida, you can still be legally fired from your job if you're gay. And Joe, I know that when you were in the state legislature, that was a big effort that you had championed for.
It was. I was the lead sponsor of the Florida Competitive Workforce Act, a bill that has, since I've left the legislature, moved into other hands, but is a bill that I think its time has come. You know, at the vigil that we held in Orlando on Monday, I would say there were a few themes that emerged from not just the speakers who had been given the microphone, but from the response that we were getting from the broader Orlando community, and not just an LGBT community that was present, but from the broader community. And, you know, the first theme was a clear call out on Islamophobia in all its forms. And I think it's important to say that out loud, because the LGBT community is a community that has experienced violence, it has experienced discrimination, it has experienced marginalization in its history. Any LGBT person that you speak to can talk about what it feels like to be afraid at times, because we're treated like we're different. And so to connect that to what the immediate narrative from some has been, which is to take us in the direction as a country as we mourn this in a way that is equally damaging and marginalizing to our Islamic brothers and sisters. I think that was a theme right away that you saw come out of Monday. A second theme was to call out gun violence, and specifically to call out elected officials who have doubled down on access to weapons of mass murder, and to start asking really hard questions about why it is that people who have been investigated multiple times by the FBI have access to major firearms as easy as you could buy a carton of eggs. That was the second theme, gun violence in all its forms and how we're going to attack it. And the third one is, I think, the theme that connects most deeply to your question, which is, how do we as a community carve down into our basic DNA to uproot 360 bigotry and discrimination and marginalization, and the basic sense that some people in this world are welcome and some aren't. And I think one of the ways that you do that is you pass laws like that of the Workforce Act, where you go to state elected officials and demand that even as they call out this for what it is, even as they, some for the first time, speak to the LGBT community and acknowledge that we're here and that we are targeted at times. I think there was a clear desire for action from elected officials and those in power who can do something. And one thing they can do is to finally, in this state, ban discrimination in employment and in housing and in public accommodation against the LGBT community. There's no greater sign that we've ever had that sometimes we are targeted. And you know, it used to be when we were talking about the culture war that it was metaphorical. This isn't a metaphor. Pulse isn't a metaphor. It's time for people to take real action and begin to send different signals about who's welcome and who's not. And I think one of the ways we can do that is by passing a statewide non-discrimination law in Florida.
Right. And I don't know if you're still in touch with folks in the state legislature, but do you know if any of your former counterparts who are still in the state House or Senate are going to be bringing that up in next year's session?
I am absolutely sure they will.
All right. And Arlene and Billy, I wanted to focus this question towards you specifically because I know you both have, you know, close connections with LGBT youth. But I would wonder if they've perhaps been particularly impacted by this event, because, you know, kids today have kind of grown up in a society that's been much more accepting than what previous generations of LGBT people have had to navigate. Arlene, I mean, have you had these conversations with kids who...
I have, and what I've heard from some of the students from FGCU, I think I'll be safer staying in my house being afraid to go out. And I said to them, that's no way to live your life. In order to get to move forward, we have to develop some action and do something. Sitting back is not going to help anything. And I think the kids have grown up. They, you know, they really haven't seen a lot. We've seen a lot of it in the past. And this is all new for them. So for them, I think this was just really, oh, my God, this can really happen.
Yeah. And Dr. Huff, I know a lot of your interaction with students it takes place a great deal outside of the classroom. And mm-hmm. you know, you have close relationships with some of your students. Have you had conversations with them or younger folks? And have you kind of gauged any sort of difference in their reaction versus, I guess for lack of a better term, veteran LGBT community members?
I actually have. And have been actually impressed with the way that they've been responding in a way that, not to use an overworn word right now, that is more radical in terms of activism. I don't think radical is always a bad thing. Really in terms of changing the ways that we talk about these things, from talking about it in terms of normalization. You know, during the marriage debate, a lot of the rhetoric was focused on, we're just like you, when the accusation was, gay people are the end of Western civilization as we know it. And they say, no, we're not. We want to get married and have babies and join the military. And just over the last few days, the things that I've seen them passing around on Facebook and social media have really changed that rhetoric, that maybe we do need to be a threat to Western civilization as we know it, because maybe it needs to change if it is one in which something like this can happen. And they're angry and they want to act and they want to do something.
Yeah, you brought up that term, you know, radicalization, and that's something that's been highly politicized recently. The presumptive Republican presidential nominee Donald Trump has criticized the Obama administration for not using the term radical Islam or not using it enough. Mohammed al-Darsani, can you give us any kind of insight into?
I would love to.
Yes, thanks.
First of all, there is no such thing called radical Islam. There are radical Muslims, and they existed from the day Islam started, in the early days of Islam, and they still exist till today. Radical Muslims. And some of them become so radicals, so militant, and so narrow-minded to the degree that they impose themselves a danger against Islam and Muslims. To the degree the Prophet himself, in one of his prophecy, said, if these people come, you should fight them and eliminate them. And if I exist, I will do that myself. Mm-hmm. Okay, this is the Islamic view. Second, radicalization. It is not, something, special for Islam or exclusive for Islam. It goes across the boards in all over the world. We have politicians who are trying to radicalize people against people who not only different from them in color or in ethnicity or whatever difference, even if your political views are not in line in what they believe, you should be removed out of the way. And unfortunately, this is very, very dangerous. And some idiotic people, mentally ill people, they may carry that into actions on their own. And to identify that, it is the job of every community, the faith community, the education community, the LGBT community. All kinds of groups should get together and work against radicalizations. We did that. As a Muslim community, we've been trying to do that to the best of our abilities and the resources available to us. For example, last November, we had a conference in Tampa to all of the imams of the United States. I was the head organizer of this conference, and we invited the highest officials and the FBI who deal with these kind of things to come and participate and try to help us and train the imams and train the Muslim community how to identify that. But that is not enough. This is, I believe, is going to be ongoing work for us for many years to come. And we would like other community to join in the same process. And let's learn from each other, cooperate with each other, and help the law enforcement again. And I, this message, and I hope the Muslims who are listening to me in our area today take it to heart. The law enforcement, FBI, sheriff's departments, police departments, when they investigate, they are not coming to persecute people. They are trying to deter something from happening. And if they come to talk to you, talk to them. Be honest with them. If the wife of this man opened her mouth and said something even to the imam of the masjid, if they were associated with the masjid, or to somebody, or herself, felt he won't be prosecuted probably for his thoughts, but at least a crime of this magnitude would have been stopped. And if you are a Muslim out there, I encourage you, if you know about anybody who has any crooked thoughts, I guarantee you it is not Islamic, and I guarantee you it is your duty to talk to the authority and raise a flag.
Mm-hmm. I wanted to ask you also, have you been in touch with imams or other members of the Orlando's Islamic community?
No, I've been following them on the social media and on the news, really. And we have an imam there called Muhammad al-Masri. He's the head of the largest organization there, and he's been there from hour one. And we're proud of what the Muslim community is doing there. CARE, the Council on American Islamic Relations, have been on the scene all this time. They've been collecting funds to help the victim's family. Most of the Muslim community there has been outpouring with support and sympathy with the people. And we hope this is a new beginning, that for all of us to get together as Americans, no matter what our faith is, no matter our political views are, to get together and make something positive out of this tragedy.
Right. And I also wanted to bring up a Donald Trump comment again. He quickly took to Twitter Sunday and, used the event as a way to advocate further his position that the United States should ban immigration from Muslim people.
Unfortunately, Trump now is the guru of Islamophobia. And no doubt in my mind, many politicians and many crooked people, many people with financial interest will exploit this situation to the max to further their agenda.
All right. Well, we are about out of time for today's show. The hour does go by fast, but I want to thank everybody who joined us today for our very somber discussion. We've been speaking with Muhammad al-Darsani, Imam and founder of the Islamic Center for Peace in Fort Myers. Always good to speak with you. Thank you.
Thank you. Can I add one little comment
sure.
here or announcements probably? There is a visual gathering today at 7 o'clock at the Unitarian Universalist Church of Daniels Parkway. I would like to let that known to the community for whoever would like to be there to come and show some support and solidarity.
All right. And Arlene Goldberg is a founder of Visuality, Inc. here in Fort Myers, and there's going to be a vigil downtown Fort Myers tonight.
No, downtown Fort Myers in Tenant Park on Saturday.
Saturday.
7 o'clock.
Saturday at 7 o'clock. Mm-hmm. All right. Dr. Billy Huff is a communication professor at the University of South Florida and remains an adjunct professor here at FGCU. Dr. Huff, great to speak with you as well.
Thank you very much.
Earlier in the program, we were joined by Joe Saunders. He's the Southern Regional Field Director for the Human Rights Campaign and a former state lawmaker representing the Orlando region. And Hannah Willard is a Policy and Outreach Coordinator for Equality Florida. We also spoke with reporter Cody Delaney, who's been covering the shooting for the News Press and USA Today. There's more information on today's show and past editions of the program online at wgcu.org/Gulf Coast Live. Continue the conversation on Facebook at WGCU Public Media and on Twitter using the hashtag Gulf Coast Live. Thanks to my producers Richard Chinqui and AJ Leonard. This is WGCU FM Fort Myers 90.1, WMKO Marco Island 91.7 FM, NPR for Southwest Florida.